Hong. And that's Mark Eastbrack. So he's going to be sparse and I'll be dense today. So I think Mark's is maybe a little bit more theoretical. It's a very, very big area. There's much to talk about. So I thought I'd purely talk about the practical aspects. So there's been a huge amount of work done in the last few years. And some of the theory we've actually been able to translate to practice and get implementations that are quite fast. So this is the problem that we're looking at, solving a linear system. So here's a non-singular system, and in particular, we want to solve it over the integers. So this is the problem that Mike talked about before lunch. And we know we can do this, it's order n cubed arithmetic operations. But of course the problem is that we have this growth in the size of numbers. So even though the input may be small numbers, in many applications that's the case, we have small numbers, but the output is large. And they're going to be n times as big. This is only a 4x4 example. We're interested in examples of dimension 10,000 along those lines. So I said I want to be practical in this part of the talk, so let me start directly, give some timings, because we have implementations that solve this particular problem. And should always list the machine we're doing the timings on. I didn't do that here. It's actually this machine here, so it's on this laptop, this IBM laptop. And if we look in order of seconds, then we have systems of dimension 1,000 or so. We can do that on the order of seconds. And minutes, maybe up to 10 minutes, we have dimension 5,000. So these are systems where the input entries are very small, but of course, we're solving a rational system. The output is going to be about 5,000 decimal digits in that case. And if we get up to dimension 8,000, then it takes about half an hour. So we think these are good timings, so these are fast. But why do we think that? So let's compare this implementation that was done by a grad student. That's the blue one here. Those were the timings from the previous slide. With the red ones, and that's an implementation. It's actually the same algorithm. That's from Victor Shoup's NTL. So that's a very general purpose. It's a totally unfair comparison. He's doing lots of stuff in there. And he also implemented the algorithm for resolving these systems. And so we see order of magnitudes difference here when we start to get out to dimension 500. And if we look at dimension 8,000, then the difference is going to be even more extreme. So I want to talk a little about why is that? How do we become successful in implementing this? So what's behind these fast implementations? So I said it's actually the same algorithm, just the implementation is different. So let's take a look at the algorithm that we're using first. So in order to get this around this problem of the fact that the numbers are getting large, so order n cubed arithmetic operations, if we worked with those large numbers, the bit complexity would be n to the 4. And then we could never get timings like on the previous slide. So instead we use a different algorithm that has bit complexity, actually it brings it back down to n cubed. And it's this lifting algorithm here. So the solution, A inverse B, we want to expand it. Periodically, we get an expansion of the solution. And this is the algorithm that's going to do it for us. So after the I iteration of this loop, we keep making this expansion here larger. So we have this identity, so we just have to work with this and try and get the expansion one more. So each one of these CI, that's a vector of small integers. And by combining them all together, we get the large solution. So what's important here, what is the dominant computational step in this algorithm? It's always these matrix operations. So matrix multiplication. Actually, we have an inverse computation here. That's in step one. And then we have the loop in step two. And that's done modulo p. So p could be, for example, a word size prime. So that step one is going to be order n cubed arithmetic operations and also order n cubed bit operations. And the loop here we have matrix vector products. That's order n squared arithmetic operations. But again, it's modulo prime. So it's also the same bit operations. And the k, that's on the order of n. So for that step, we have n times n squared. So it's an n cubed algorithm. And this has been known since the 80s. It's been presented by Dixon or Munk and Carter. So it's actually the same algorithm we're implementing. So why is the blue algorithm much faster? Well, our emphasis was on asymptotic complexity, trying to solve large problems in a reasonable amount of time. So if we look here, NTL is actually pretty good for small size problems. So the emphasis wasn't to solve these huge linear algebra problems. That was our emphasis. So how are we achieving this good running time? So there's a couple of reasons for that, and that's because one thing what NTL is not doing that we're doing is we're reducing, trying to reduce as much as possible to matrix multiplication. So we're using recursive divide and conquer algorithms to reduce the matrix multiplication. And then the matrix multiplication, these steps, we're using highly optimized numerical libraries to handle them. And they achieve a running time. They use the CPU pretty well, as much as can be used. So if there's a certain number of floating point operations that the CPU is supposed to be able to do, we pretty much maximize that. So here's an example of what that looks like. So on the bottom here is Atlas. LOS, that stands for Automatically Tuned Linear Algebra Subroutines. LOS is just basic linear algebra subroutines. So these are actually numerical routines working with doubles, floating point numbers. But as long as our prime is small enough, we can use these routines and not lose any precision. And that's what we're doing here. So this word size linear algebra, that's working modulo prime. We're trying to reduce as much as possible operations like computing a null space, computing a rank. We use recursive algorithms to reduce that to matrix multiplication. Then we can take advantage of these libraries here. And that's what gives the big performance gain. And then up the top there, the non-singer solving, that ends up being the most fundamental problem on now bit complexity, where we have to concern with the growth of numbers. And eventually we do have to work with big numbers, and then we use GMP, the multiple precision library. And at the very top, just linear algebra, it turns out that non-singular solving, that's somehow the fundamental problem in the bit complexity. So if we can solve that, then many other problems like Hermite form, Smith form, then we can solve those as well. So there's a lot of optimizations to get the timings that I talked about, especially from the non-singular solving over Z, going down to word size linear algebra. A lot of work done there. It was a project maybe 1.5 years that a master's student did. That's a little bit too much to talk about. I just want to talk about this area here. This has been very well studied, and how do we achieve some results there in the word size? So here's an example of the problems we want to solve, all the basic linear algebra problems. So rank, determinant, null space, inverse, system solving. And we want to reduce them to matrix multiplication. And there's no algorithms for doing that. So that we can use that highly optimized library. So let's look at the alternatives here. So on the right here, we have this recursive approach, for example, for computing the inverse. We compute this LUP factorization. And what was the original motivation there when that was developed in the 70s? That was to get the exponent of matrix multiplication. So we can compute the inverse not in n cubed. We can compute it in n to the whatever you want, 2.78, 2.376, using the fastest exponent. And on the left here, we have the tried and true practical method, just a triply nested for loop. So we just do the elimination, compute the inverse directly. So this is nice. It's a very simple algorithm. We can implement it in 5 minutes. The constant inside the big O is very small. In fact, it's 2. It's 2 n cubed plus O of n squared. And it works in place. So this has some good features. So for example, in NTL, this is the implementation that's used. This is this classical iterative one to compute the inverse modulo p. And let's compare it with the recursive one. So to actually compare it, we have to look at an implementation. So I'll look at an implementation in Maple. So the iterative one is actually written in C code. It's in the kernel of Maple, computer algebra system. And for smallish matrices, it's very good because it has very low latency. We call it, it works in place, and it's quite optimized. It's a 2n cubed algorithm. And the recursive algorithm, I actually wrote it in Maple code, so it's interpreted. So there's a huge amount of overhead there. So if we apply it on a dimension 10,000 matrix, we're going to have 10,000 by 10,000 recursive calls in the bottom level with Maple calls. So there's a very high latency there. There's a lot of overhead. But in the end, everything boils down to these operations here, this add multiple. So this takes a submatrix and another submatrix, then it calls that highly optimized library, it multiplies them together, puts the result somewhere else. Or just the multiply command. Multiply A times B and put the result in C. And if you look at the recurrence, for example, for an n by n matrix, it might look like 4 subproblems of maybe half the size, and then combining work here is, well, here the exponent of matrix multiplication, but I can just write a 3. So what's a feature of this recurrence here is that it's very top heavy. So all the interesting stuff is going on in the small, when we're recursing on the small matrices, choosing the pivots and all the computation. But in the end, this very top level of the recursion tree, that dominates all the cost. So pretty well that last call to multiply, we're multiplying matrices of dimension n over 2, pretty much all the cost is there. And that's been highly optimized by that numerical library. So below the second level of the recursion, it doesn't contribute much at all to the overall running time. So we don't have to worry about optimizing code. We just have to make sure that these matrix multiplications are optimized. So here's an example of where the crossover is. So it might be a little hard to see. Here, for about dimension 300 or 310, then the recursive algorithm starts to become faster. But somehow it's not that interesting. At that point, we're only taking a fraction of a second, say around 0.4 seconds. So let's try some larger examples. It's going up to 400 here. If we try a larger example, if we go up to 8,000, then we get something that looks like this. So we compare the times of the recursive to the iterative approach. So they're both n cubed algorithms. But because we're using an optimized library, we get a much better running time. So when we first created this graph, there somehow it wasn't so compelling because we can make the graph look like anything we want. We can choose the index here and make it as sloped as we want or not. We can play around with that. So we were wondering how effective is this reduction to matrix multiplication, this recursive algorithm. So we thought we'd try a different timing. So I said the matrix multiplication itself, that's highly optimized using that library. It's using a processor pretty well as much as possible. So many person years went into development of that library just to handle that matrix multiplication. So let's compare our recursive algorithm for computing inverse directly to matrix multiplication itself. And so we'll call that a ratio test. And that's how we want to answer this question here. Is it, if we improve that matrix multiplication, how much is that going to improve our algorithm for inverse? Or how much extra work is being done by all the recursive calls and so on? So we want to compare the running time of matrix multiplication with our inverse routine. And then we get something that looks like this. So here for dimension 500, 1000, 1500, the ratio is about between 2 and 3. So our algorithm takes 2 and 3 times as long to compute the inverse as it would be to just multiply the matrices numerically. But as we get out to here, 4000, and maybe way out to here, 8000, it's becoming very close to 1.5. And that's pretty much the constant we expect. It's about 3 halves. So inverse is about 3 halves times the cost of matrix multiplication as the dimension is getting large. So it says that we're making very good use of that fast library for matrix multiplication. And if somebody improves that matrix multiplication, that's directly going to improve all of these linear algebra problems. So it works not just for inverse, but also for all the other problems as well. So here's the ratio test for determinant. And here, even by 1,000, 1,500 dimension, we're going up to 8,000. Already it's reaching the optimal, which is about one half. So to compute the determinant takes about half as long as to compute a matrix multiplication. So for example, for a 10,000 matrix, we can compute it in less than 10 minutes, the determinant. So this was modulo, this was modulo prime. So that's this area here. So this area of the dense linear algebra working mono prime, that's very well understood. And pretty much everything has been translated to practice. So if you want to compute a null space or rank, you can find libraries on the web that'll do that, and you can download them. So what we're working on now, and we have an implementation, is for non-singular solving, the bit complexity where the numbers grow. And the theory is very well understood. It takes some time to translate into practice, so that's what we're working on now. So we have implementations there as well for the dense case. And then we also want to get Hermite form and Smith form in the dense case as well. And I'll pass it off to Mark now.
Microphone. Oh. They're recording. Smooth transition.
Hello?
Okay, I got it. Good.
So Yeah, as Arne said, he's dense and I'm sparse or something like that, but I'm relatively dense too. So this is the second part, which is not as, I'll have to speak slowly. What Arne was speaking of was algorithms which ultimately were n cubed in cost, and that was counting machine words. So I mean, we're taking into account that things get big. You know, the output is very big, and even so, Dixon's algorithm or Monk and Carter from mid 1980s gave an n cubed complexity, and we really haven't improved that much, other than playing with asymptotically fast matrix arithmetic. You know, the ability to multiply matrices in n to the Strassen 2.8 whatever, and you know, down to Coppersmith and Winograd, down to n to the 2.37. I don't want to use that stuff. I want to talk about grinding the constant down below n cubed for matrices which look like this, and this is supposed to be a sparse matrix, in terms of the bit complexity, the amount, number of real machine words that you're going to use. And this is a somewhat more bleeding edge talk, and so, which generally means I'll talk about theory and algorithms first, and then I'll actually put up some practical results at the very end. And so this is work that was presented last summer by Wayne Eberle and me and Pascal Georgi, who was a postdoc in Waterloo, and Arne Stroyohan and Jules Villard in Lyon. And so this is new. This is also a picture of a sparse matrix. So this is a triplets matrix. And one of the things, the point I wanted to make is that when we think of a sparse matrix, what we're really thinking of is a black box. And the black box is something that allows you to do matrix vector product quickly. Okay, so that's our definition of a black box. And whenever I say counting operations, I mean counting real machine operations. So I'm not cheating by shoving in huge integers, or I'm not cheating by counting operations over some abstract field. I'm actually talking about machine operations. There will be places where I hide things in big O notation, but in the end, I will present some preliminary but still relatively compelling implementation results. Okay, so this is just a summary, essentially, of what Arne did. But if I take the methods that Arne was speaking of, essentially Dixon's the n cubed algorithm, and run them on a sparse matrix, what happens? Well, what happens is that if you do it directly, things will start to fill in. So you start to introduce non-zeros where you used to have zeros. Or if you use an iterative a lifting algorithm, it's actually going to take n lifting steps, and each lifting step costs you n squared time, or thereabouts. I'm going to assume constant. Whenever I ignore this log of the norm of A, that's the size of the entries in my input matrix. And for the rest of this talk, I'm going to assume that those are small. So that, like the examples that Arne gave, you know, small integers in your matrix, big matrix. And so really everything still costs n cubed. So that's exactly the same as it was in the dense case. Sparse, dense, still costs n cubed. So this isn't very good. And so sparse matrices over a field seem to be a little easier. So for example, over GF2, if we have a n by n matrix and it's only got, say, 3n entries, we can actually compute the matrix vector product very, very quickly. And there was an algorithm by Doug Wiedemann and subsequent work for things like Lanchos and all these sorts of things, which actually show that you're able to do this in approximately solve a system over a field in about n squared operations. So that's better. Now, these are operations in the field, and of course, if I say they're operations in the rational numbers, I would be cheating, or I would be violating my rule of actually counting the size of the integers involved, because over the rational numbers, everything gets big. So ultimately, if I run this over Q, I'm still using n cubed operations, and that's bad, real machine operations. So the goal is faster algorithms for sparse integer matrices. And as Arne said, there's a link. I'm going to talk about linear system solving, but really this is sort of the linchpin to a whole bunch of other things, including Smith form and determinant, and pretty much every other linear algebra operation, Diophantine equations, linear Diophantine equations, These are all very, very closely linked. So everything I say for one can pretty much be related to the others. The practicalities of these relations is not as well established as for the dense case that Arne talked about. So obviously matrices arising in practice may have very large dimension. They may often have a very small number of non-zero elements per row. And now classical Gaussian elimination can be used. And in fact, a lot of this area involves staring at the numerical literature, which is considerably older and somewhat broader. And you say, oh, well, what can we take from the people who are doing large sparse matrices in the numerical areas? And they have something which is very effective called super LU. And that's it's a way of doing a decomposition of a sparse matrix. And you can actually implement that over the integers, and you get somewhere, and this has been done by Jean-Guillaume Dumas in Grenoble, and it actually gets you somewhere, but not as far as you would like. And there's also these iterative methods that I've said over finite fields, which are very intriguing because they have that n squared complexity, and there's a whole series of results along those lines. The last one is perhaps going to be the most, last two are going to be perhaps the most leading for us because they're called block algorithms. So this is where instead of thinking where we're going to sort of go towards Arne's approach of taking like chunks of matrices, and so we can use linear algebra with matrices over a small field. So we're going to sort of block things out, which will make it much friendlier to our computers. Okay, so let's look at these algorithms where we actually did have some success, and that is sparse matrices over fields. So I want to solve a sparse matrix over a finite field, and the classic method to do this is what's called Wiedemann's algorithm. It's a Krylov type algorithm. The 2-minute guide is as follows. You choose a random u and a random v, which are a row vector and a column vector. You generate this linear recurring sequence, uv, uav, ua squared v, etc., and you say, what is the minimal polynomial of that sequence? Now, it's a sequence of elements in the field. You can solve its minimal polynomial. With high probability, that's also going to be the minimal polynomial of the matrix. Okay? High probability for your choice of random elements u and v, random vectors u and v. Once I have the minimal polynomial of the matrix, I can then construct a solution from that minimal polynomial. I have basically said what how B and the iterates of A to the IB are related, and I can construct X from that. So that's the fundamental idea behind Wiedemann's algorithm. And this is essentially the same as it's very similar to the Lanczos algorithm. It's very similar to the conjugate gradient algorithm. There's a whole series of algorithms like this. The cost is 2n matrix vector products and an extra n squared operations, and there's lots of improvements of this. I'm just presenting a variant of the fundamental algorithm. So let's just try this. Ignore the stuff that's sort of grayed out, the phases, but just look at the phase one, phase two, phase three, the headers here. The first, I'm going to try this now over the integers. I'm going to choose a random prime. I'm going to choose a prime, small prime p. I'm going to solve the system mod p. I'm then going to compute a p-adic approximation. I'm going to do the lifting algorithm, Dixon's lifting algorithm. I'm going to lift approximately n times. And then I'm going to use rational reconstruction to reconstruct the rational numbers in the solution. Basically a version of Chinese remaindering, the Chinese remainder theorem for rational numbers. And I'm going to do the output. Now, there's lots of optimizations that you can make to each stage of this to do it right, but let's just look at the complexity. So the complexity of the first stage is solving it mod p, which I said before, it's n squared. That's okay. Complexity of the second stage is approximately t times n. Somehow t has been lost in this. But, t is the degree of the minimal polynomial. So it's the degree of the minimal polynomial times n, which is the size of my matrix, plus that's the number of non-zero elements. Essentially, this here is n squared. k is the number of steps I have to lift. N squared times n, we're back to n cubed. So something went wrong here. So what happened was that our algorithm, which was good in the sparse matrix case, for a small field, when I decided to do lifting, each lifting step cost too much. It cost n squared. Even though the initial solving mod p was fast, the lifting steps cost too much. So that's bad. And it's more complicated. So it's both more complicated and slower. So we don't like this. I'll actually compare an implementation later. So this is actually proposed in 1991 by Eric Heltofen and David Saunders. There are some reasons to look at this. One of the reasons is that for sparse matrices, it's often the case that the minimal polynomial has very low degree. And so that lifting step is not necessarily as bad as one might imagine. So for some matrices, that's okay. But overall, you know, we're still talking n cubed operations with machine words, and it's not as fast as we would like. So we want to do better than that. So our objectives are to get an algorithm which takes n to the theta operations, where theta is less than 3, and I'm not going to bore you with asymptotic algorithms for matrix multiplication. So in some sense, I'm not going to cheat. I'm going to use standard arithmetic, standard matrix arithmetic. I'm not even going to use Strassen's algorithm. And so that's what I'm going to spend the next 10, 15 minutes talking about, is how I'm going to get a subcubic algorithm for solving sparse linear systems over the integers. And the way we proceed is very much as it was in Wiedemann's algorithm. In Wiedemann's algorithm, we chose a random row and a random column, u and v, and I constructed the sequence uv, uav, ua squared v, ua cubed v. This was a linear recurring sequence. But now, instead of a single row and single column v, I'm going to choose a block, a view that has S rows and a V that has S columns. And I'm going to start out by choosing these over the rationals. That's not really the right thing to do, but as it will turn out. But I'm going to start out by doing this. So now what do I get when I compute U A to the I V? I have a sequence of S by S matrices. So whereas before it was a sequence of 1 by 1 matrices, field elements, now I've got a sequence of S by S matrices. And so I have this U, UAV, UA squared B, etc. This is, again, a linear recurring sequence. And there exists what's called a matrix polynomial. It's a polynomial with matrix coefficients, F0, F1, up to Ft. These are S by S matrices now. And I can write these as I can say that there's a linear dependence between the elements of the field, of the sequence, which is given by these matrices F0 through Ft. So I can then say that, in fact, for any I can say, basically I can say what the next element of the sequence is simply as a linear relation on the previous t elements in the sequence. I can do the same trick that I did in Wiedemann's algorithm. I can write this linear recurrent sequence as a polynomial. It's a matrix polynomial now. The coefficients are matrices. And the cool thing is that now I can take this matrix polynomial, and if I compute its determinant, that actually turns out to be the characteristic polynomial of A with high probability. Okay, so I've done essentially the trick that Wiedemann had, but now I've converted it to a matrix polynomial. Better than that, the sequence UV, UAV, UA squared V, etc., doesn't have to be as long. So I can actually choose a much shorter sequence before I can figure out this linear recurring this relationship. And so I've got a trade-off now. I've got what's sometimes been called the baby step, giant step algorithm for computing the determinant of a matrix, which was introduced by Keltofen and Villard. I've sort of traded off the the length of the sequence that I need to go to get this linear recurrence, and the other cost that sort of keeps it down at the other end is the actual computation of the determinant of this matrix polynomial. That was free in the Wiedemann case, in the scalar case. Now that actually has some cost. So I have two competing costs, and I can choose the balance. So the algorithm itself, you don't need to look at the details of this, but there is the computation of the sequence, uv, uav, ua squared v, etc. I compute the sequence. I can find its block minimal polynomial. I'll talk a little bit about more of that later. I compute the characteristic polynomial, which is the determinant, and I evaluate that. The determinant of the characteristic polynomial, and if I evaluate that at zero, I actually get the determinant of the original matrix. So what are the advantages? Well, the advantages are now I'm working with matrices instead of elements. So I'm able to use some of the things that Arne was talking about, which is these matrix-matrix operations, and that actually turns out to be very good both in practice and in theory. And I've been talking about an algorithm which computes the determinant of a matrix here, but the solver is actually pretty similar. To solve a system actually turns out to be pretty similar. So that's the quote, advantages of this algorithm. Of course, the disadvantages are pretty much the same as the last one. It's more complicated and it's slower. So this is not so good. We pretend there's advantages, but really, in the end, all these wonderful trade-offs that we had really don't buy us anything. The cost is still n cubed. So where am I going with this is the next question. And I won't bore you with too many details here because I don't have too much time left, but what we then said, okay, well, what would make this faster? What actually would make this faster? I'll go back one step to here, and I'll look at this u and this v. And it turns out there's a lot of time being spent multiplying a times v and a squared v, and then pre-multiplying it with u. We're spending, if you actually to balance out the complexity, you would see that's a good part of the time. And so what we tried to do was that we said, okay, well, if we're spending a lot of time multiplying by u, and u is random, how about if we choose a u and a v, which are actually sparse? Will they work? So you have u, uv, uav, ua squared v, there's this sequence, and now I've chosen u to have this special structure, which makes it very, very quick to do this. Will the algorithm still work? Well, that's the question. To jump ahead to the answer is that if it does work, we actually get an algorithm which now takes, using exactly the same techniques, approximately n to the 2.67. These are real machine operations, n to the 2.67, 2 2/3. So that's good. Does the algorithm work with high probability? Remember, all these are probabilistic algorithms. Once you get the answer, you know you have the answer right. But the algorithm itself makes some random choices, just as Wiedemann's algorithm does, Lanczos' algorithm does. All these algorithms for sparse matrices make random choices. What happened there? I won't go into the conjecture. The conjecture is that everything works. It's a conjecture that actually has soaked up an awful lot of time. I believe it's a conjecture that's proven, but it's well beyond the lecture here. Okay, so we think that now, if you buy my conjecture, that we have an algorithm that takes n to 2 2/3. I'll convince you later that, in fact, the practice is that it takes n to the 2 2/3. So this works. I mean, it does work in practice. The question is, does it work in theory as well for all matrices? Well, the answer is I still can't say it concretely, but I certainly have a pretty good feeling that it does. But now, n to the 2 2/3, we can actually do better. So we actually want to talk about doing better, and this is the algorithm we have implemented that I'm talking about here. We can do something similar again, and now choose a sparse u and a sparse v. So you have a matrix on the left, u, and a matrix on the right, v. You compute the sequence, uv, uav, a squared v, etc. And now we want to find the minimal polynomial of this, or actually, we want to look at sort of the way that one would solve a system using this this linear recurrence here. So we put these elements into this matrix that's essentially describing the linear recurrence, and this is what's called a Bloch-Hankel matrix. Now the cool thing about a Bloch-Hankel matrix is in fact that you can compute the inverse of a Bloch-Hankel matrix more quickly than you can compute the inverse of a general matrix. So actually this is in some sense a sparser matrix than your original matrix A. And so what we're going to do is we're going to write the inverse of A, which we needed at every single lifting step, we're going to write it in terms of H, in terms of this Bloch-Hankel matrix. So there is our H up there. We have all these iterates of this linear recurring sequence. Construct another matrix KU and another matrix KV. And now the inverse of A, which is the thing that we needed at every single lifting step in our linear solver, we're going to write as KB times H to the minus 1 times KU. KU looks like that. It turns out to be really easy to multiply a vector by KU. H is this Bloch-Hankel matrix. Turns out to be really, well, relatively easy, or easier, to invert a Bloch-Hankel matrix, or to evaluate the inverse of a Bloch-Hankel matrix, than it is to evaluate the inverse of A. KV looks like that. It's also a matrix, which is relatively easy to apply to a vector. So now we have, once we have this H, and once we've sort of have this Bloch-Hankel matrix H, now we have a way of applying the inverse of A to a vector which is faster than the standard representation, assuming that A is in fact a sparse matrix. If you buy all this and you run essentially the same algorithm where you're lifting each time, the ultimate cost is going to be n to the 2.5. Now, there's a little tilde there. A little tilde says there's actually some there's some logarithmic factors. But the ultimate cost is still n to the 2.5, which is a big improvement on n cubed, or at least you think it would be. So first of all, I should say the algorithm does work. The conjecture, even if it's not proven, is true, but we think it's proven. And we have an algorithm which takes n to the 2.5. Takes in the sense of an asymptotic analysis. And whenever somebody who does asymptotic linear algebra for a living says something takes n to the 2.5, you should be very skeptical of whether or not it runs. So I'm going to skip this. This is actually a description of how that Bloch-Hankel matrix inversion works, but I won't bore you with the details. And there's the algorithm itself. So this is exactly the same thing. We have phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3. Ignore the parts. I didn't gray them out quite enough. It's pretty much the same algorithm as the one that Arne described, the one that I described earlier using Wiedemann's algorithm. Basically, I'm computing the inverse mod p, except now I'm actually computing the inverse using that matrix H mod p, that Bloch-Hankel matrix, and I'm doing a bunch of lifting steps. And the main point is that, in fact, the cost of the lifting steps went down. My lifting steps are cheaper. Okay, so I've moved some cost. Actually, I've had to do some more pre-computation, but I've moved the cost into the... I've lowered the cost of the lifting steps. So now if you look at the total cost at the bottom, it's n to the 2.5. Okay, so now for the real stuff. So that was the airy-fairy theoretical stuff. And now I look at some small systems of equations. So these are 10 elements per row on an Itanium 1.3. These were done by Pascal Georgi, who implemented a whole bunch of algorithms. This is Maple. Maple is actually an implementation. This is mostly to embarrass Maple, I think. But Maple is an implementation of Chinese remaindering. There is something interesting here. If you're actually trying to implement linear solving using Chinese remaindering, this should be the last, you know, you should never look beyond this. It's terrible. I mean, Chinese remaindering is actually n to the 4th algorithm. And everybody seems to forget that in the 80s, John Dixon came up with an n-cubed algorithm. So there's no excuse for this. P-Attic-Wiedemann is actually slower than the methods that Arne talked about. That was, it's just there for comparison. The real comparison here is this very, very tight, very, very careful implementation of Dixon's algorithm. And this is using... Oh, we didn't feed the computer enough. We fed ourselves. Is it trying to tell me something? Yeah, I know. Yeah. Now you get halfway. This is really going to confuse it. So now it's totally hibernated. It's an extra password too, isn't it? It's not. This is a demonstrator. He did the experiments on his laptop. This is a demonstration of how fast it is. Yeah, right. Yeah, if only he had a Mac. Thanks.
Now you
tell. Yeah. Okay, there's my talk again. So there's Dixon's algorithm. This is this very, very careful, very tight version of p-adic lifting Dixon's algorithm. And there's our algorithm. Well, you can see that at 3600 by 3600 matrix, we managed to shave 3 seconds off the cost of solving a system. And that actually is, I think Pascal was very proud of that. this was big stuff, right? Because you have to imagine, I mean, the machinery for solving that block Hankel matrix is actually pretty impressive stuff. I mean, this is fairly tough stuff. And so this is an algorithm which really a few years ago we would have thought as being living in that airy fairy world of asymptotically fast niceties that really don't affect us in practice. And really what this is saying is that these algorithms are going to be practical at some point. Now, things are a little better when we get to slightly bigger matrices. So, in fact, when we look at, this is again with 10 elements per row, these are small elements. We get up to 14,000 by 14,000, 14,400 by 14,400, which was actually about that blue one that I showed you at the very head of my first slide. It's approximately twice as fast. You know, so it's competitive. There's a reason to do this, and unfortunately, I mean, this is not an easy game. The growth with respect to the number of elements per row, there's a dependency on the number of elements per row. Dixon's algorithm is actually much less sensitive to the number of elements per row, and so. In fact, as 30 elements per row, the gain on Dixon's algorithm is not as impressive. In fact, so it's interesting. You're looking at algorithms which have a gap in complexity of n to the 1/2, right? And you're seeing the actual speed up, you know, after a lot of work by a very good programmer, you know, who understood things very deeply, is approximately a factor of 2. So this is, you know, so a lot has been lost in the implementation in a sense. So where does this leave us? Where this leaves us is that we now have algorithms for sparse solving, determinant, Smith form, a number of other things related with complexity approximately 2.67. So that was actually the first one I showed you. A little more briefly, that didn't use the Hankel matrix. It was essentially a version of Kelthoffen and Villard's algorithm. The algorithm with the block Hankel matrix, I showed you the implementation. The first one is not implemented. So the first methods are not implemented, but they give us sort of these more powerful things that you know many of you in this room are looking for. The sparse solving itself gives us n to the 2.5. We'd love to say that we could find the Smith form in n to the 2.5. In fact, we'd love to say that the Smith form algorithm is in fact practical, but it's a rather strange theoretical reduction to finding that block minimal polynomial. And as Arne mentioned, I mean, improving efficiency is done by minimizing the sparse matrix operations and maximizing the use of BLAS, which is the basic linear algebra subroutines. And once again, we're using the numerical analysts here. We're using their very, very careful implementations of matrix multiplication, et cetera, that are hand-programmed to every architecture that's out there, and often dynamically programmed. So things like Atlas, where they go in and look around at your computer and optimize very specifically through the cache configuration and things like this. So what are we doing now? Well, this conjecture has taken inordinate amount of time to prove. As anyone who's worked on things like this or worked even within the numerical setting, these are well-known hard problems to prove, but are essentially related to stability results of iterative algorithms. So it's tough stuff. We think we have a proof, and so we think we have these complexities. Optimize the code. A small bit of cheating that I didn't tell you about was that when I say, oh, we choose that S. Remember, I'm choosing block matrices, so instead of choosing one by vectors and rows, I'm actually choosing S by N blocks and N by S blocks. The blocking choice to get the best asymptotic complexity is not the same blocking choice to get the same algorithm cost, running time on, for example, Arne's laptop. And so there's a science that certainly goes on in the numerical community, and we're sort of learning about how to do automatic choice of block dimensions. So to actually figure out what the correct block dimension is when we're actually solving the system. And there's a whole bunch of, for if you're into that kind of thing, asymptotic implications. So what does this mean when, in fact, you do have a matrix multiplication algorithm that takes n to the 2.37, or a mythical one that takes n squared? What does this do for you? So I think I'll conclude there. That's sort of a very fast tour of where we have come from and where the bleeding edge is. We hope the bleeding edge is of interest to some people here. And thank you very much for inviting us to speak.
Well, thank you very much for speaking.
Dan.
Software online?
So this... There's two libraries. The stuff that Arne was speaking about is IML. Do you have is it just going to be under your name, or is it?
Search for IML.
Which is Integer Matrix Library. And. It's. No, linalg.com. Illinois Municipal League, yes. So, the sparse stuff is in linalg.org, which is the Linbox library, and that's a big sort of multinational group, maybe 10 sort of principal investigators who get together occasionally and put down code, or actually more likely think about algorithms. So, yes? Oh, okay, so that's a fair question. Yeah, in the last few weeks, we believe we have a proof of the conjecture, but I don't want to suggest. I mean, it's not written down, it's not published, we're confident, but we're not. Once bitten, twice shy. We thought what we had was a proof in the spring, and it fell to pieces, and we were annoyed and embarrassed and all those things, so. So now I've just announced it here, and so when this one falls this hard, I've only got a few people to worry about. But yeah, it will be proven. To be fair to my colleagues at the very least, the algorithms work. I don't think there's any question of whether they work. The other thing I didn't mention is to get even if you do have this proof, it assumes some properties of the matrix which you can obtain by preconditioning, and so really to have the theoretical complexity. you would have to do this rather ugly preconditioning, which you would never do, and it works anyway because, you know, unless you pathologically constructed the matrix, it's not going to fall into one of these preconditioned cases. So, and at the end, you actually have a very quick test of whether or not you have a solution. So it's not a big problem. So it doesn't really affect your life, the fact that we can't prove things well. Yes. Don't do that. Magma is the obvious one to compare it to. It does use Dixon's algorithm, though it does not use Atlas and things like this. So I mean, it will run something. Let's see if I can find the. I haven't tried it on the big examples, but I think we tried it a while back, and it sort of falls. So I guess the truth is that none of them do a great job of integer linear algebra. And the ones who do it right tend to fall somewhere slower than this, you know, along the lines at NTL, you know, so Magma at NTL, as I recall, and this is, I mean, this may not be being fair, but Magma at NTL were sort of in the same league, in that they did a good basic implementation of Dixon's algorithm. It's the same algorithm for DIMS. Yeah, nobody is doing any, I mean, prior to this, I don't know of any work that's looked at sparse matrices different from dense matrices for integer matrices where you're dealing with coefficient growth. The right thing to do, as this shows, is in fact is to do Dixon's algorithm. You know, and in fact the MAPLE one, as Arne said, is quite unfair because actually for the kind of matrices where most people will be working in a system like MAPLE or Mathematica, these are actually very competitive algorithms. They're very tuned to relatively small matrices, 100 by 100. So that's where you're going to win on. You know, so to do this properly as opposed to sort of I was gonna say like we didn't hear, but no. I mean, to do this in a systematic way across the system, you're gonna have to parcel it off and to say, you know, like matrices smaller than 10 by 10, you're gonna do this, and it's 10 to 100, you're gonna do this. And there's a lot of work for example, for the people in MAPLE and Mathematica to do to get these things right. And what we've actually got in Linbox is a connection from Linbox to MAPLE. So you can actually, if you say I have a sparse integer matrix and I want to ship it off to Linbox. You can, in theory, do this. I'm not sure what state that code's in. It is shipped with it, but I'm not sure what state it's in. So I a little hesitate. Yeah, you know, that's new. So.
Okay. Then we have a call break, so please send me in that
You left me more time than that. Yeah. Yeah, well, we gave them an extra 2 minutes. So should we hang around till 3:30 and then take coffee? I need some liquid.